to it.
Everybody right there.
Get involved.
Everybody, you.
Hey, everybody. It's a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins podcast. Thanks for downloading us. And my thanks to great listeners who got up, got into it, and got involved with our show. They're voluntary subscribers. Our own Hearst Foundation, Gillian G. Hearst, Gail of Created by Gail, John DeVries, and Teresa Paris. Just some of those who voluntarily support this program. You can do it too. Go to my website, peterbcollins.com. The links are on the right-hand side of the homepage. And our voluntary subscriptions start at $5 a month. Toward the end of this podcast, you'll hear from Will Durst about Wienergate before it gets stale. Well, maybe it already has. I have not mistweeted. I have other human foibles, but that's one thing I haven't done. Today's podcast is the next installment in the Boiling Frogs interview series, co-hosted with Sabelle Edmonds. And today we hear Paul Craig Roberts. He was an official in the Reagan administration's Treasury Department. He's been outspoken in questioning the official story of 9/11. And he's skeptical about a lot of other issues, too. Listen, here comes Paul Craig Roberts on the Boiling Frogs. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the days are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight is fixed. The poor stay poor.
Everybody knows, but do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs. With Sabelle Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. Our guest today is Paul Craig Roberts, a man with a very interesting background. He served on Capitol Hill for Senator Orrin Hatch and Congressman Jack Kemp. He served in the Reagan administration as an Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. He has been a fellow at the Cato Institute and the Hoover Institution. He has written numerous books and has been outspoken on a number of issues, including, as a Republican, a critic of the George W. Bush administration, including calling for the impeachment of President Bush back, I believe, in 2005. Paul Craig Roberts, thank you for joining us today on the Boiling Frogs.
Pleased to be with you, Peter.
Well, it's nice to talk with you, and Sabelle and I have been following your work for some time. And I first learned about you when you wrote some pieces raising questions about the official narrative of the events of September 11, 2001. And in today's conversation, we want to talk about the recent accounts of the killing of Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, the growth of a police state in the United States, the failure of our media to properly challenge authority and to represent the interests of the people, and some troubling developments in the Obama administration related to what I refer to as summary execution. And almost all of these issues are pivoted on the events of 9/11. And I'd like you to articulate for our listeners as we open here your view of what we know, what we don't know, and how it has affected domestic and foreign policy in the United States over the past 10 years.
You're speaking of 9/11.
I am. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, Peter, let me say that what I have done with regard to 9/11 is to report questions that experts have raised. I myself haven't raise questions because I'm not a chemist, a physicist, an engineer, an architect, a pilot, or a firefighter. But experts in those categories have raised questions that have gone ignored and unanswered. And I have reported that these questions are out there and they are unanswered and ignored. I get quite astonished when there are 1,500 architects and engineers who send a petition to every member of Congress asking for a real investigation and are dismissed as conspiracy kooks.
Mm-hmm.
How are experts kooks? You know, once the experts become a kook, there's no way to ever question anything the government says, because there's no basis for questioning it. An expert is a kook, and who else would know enough to question? So I think that is sort of the most serious achievement of the 9/11 event, is that experts who question what the government tells us are now kooks.
Well, and in particular, Richard Gage is the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. I've interviewed him many times. I've appeared on stage at public events with him. And I have seen the data, the evidence that he has mustered to raise important questions about the official narrative, about the narrative presented by the Kane-Hamilton Commission. And I believe that he's raised very important questions that deserve to be investigated. And furthermore, you once contributed a book blurb to one of David Ray Griffin's books. And he, of course, is a retired theologian who has written more than 10 books about 9/11, painstakingly analyzing the evidence presented and trying to square that with the basic rules of physics and timelines and other ways of trying to analyze the information that we have been offered. And it leaves us with serious doubts about what we've been told. And I'm not one of the people who then jumps to a conclusion and says, well, it was an inside job. All I can say is that the information that's been presented by the government and the media to the American people is contradictory in many respects, does not square with physics, particularly when you talk about the towers in New York, and I'm referring to all three. And so we have to use that, I think, as a premise to then look at the events that occurred subsequently, because it raises serious doubts about whether we can trust our government.
Well, I think that's an open and shut case. We cannot. In fact, we've reached the point, haven't we, where the government has so little respect for the population that doesn't even bother to tell credible lies. But before we leave this 9/11, you left out the research paper that was led by the nanochemist from the University of Copenhagen, Niels Harrit, which reported unequivocally finding unreacted particles of nanothermite in the dust samples. And this has been something of a sensation in Europe, and recently he was invited to tour a number of the Canadian universities to present his findings. As far as I know, this has never been reported in the American media.
No.
Of course, American university dared ask him.
Well, the only thing I would add is that Professor Stephen Jones, now retired from Brigham Young University, conducted similar studies, and I'm not familiar with the professor you cite from Copenhagen, but Professor Jones did
I know all about Professor Jones, but yeah. Jones was looking at bits of the dust. He didn't say he found nanothermite. He said that it would explain what he did find.
Mm-hmm.
But he was also part of the team, I believe, that Niels Harrit assembled. And there were one or two other physicists and some engineers. And they actually found the particles themselves, and they took some of those particles and reacted it, and it was nanothermite. And they say they have other unreacted particles that they're pleased for any scientist anywhere to take and examine, but I don't think they've had any takers.
Mm-hmm.
The science today depends heavily on government grants, and it's very easy to have your career destroyed by getting on the wrong side of the government. So,
absolutely true. One example of it, in the past 6-7 years, I've been getting, you know, various invitations from various universities to go and talk about, you know, civil liberties, state secrets, privilege, etc. Yet, you know, the universities here in Washington, D.C., those I attended, George Washington University and George Mason University, I never got anything from them and was just curious. So I asked a friend of mine who actually has a pretty high-level position in the administration for George Washington University, and she said, well, we rarely get big grants from the federal government, especially from the FBI because of the joint work we do for their forensic science department. And the last thing they want is for us to have controversial people like yourself, and because of that, it's an absolute no-no. But
right.
mean, actually, they told me that that was the reason.
Yes, I'm sure that's the reason. There's no doubt about it.
So, Paul Craig Roberts, were you at all uncomfortable on the evening of May 1st, U.S. time, when the president went on television late night to report that special forces had located and dispatched Osama bin Laden? And the president premised the operation with references to the events of 9/11.
Yes, well, 9/11 is the new Pearl Harbor that the neoconservatives said they needed in order to launch their wars in the Middle East. Their wars for American and Israeli hegemony. And so that in itself makes 9/11 suspicious. And of course, it's justified illegal wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, now Libya, and all sorts of military interventions that we've made everywhere else. We've turned Pakistan into a war zone, as Yemen, Somalia. We now have the U.S. Africa Command. So 9/11, and at home we have a domestic police state. That's all. It's the only way you can describe what we have now. So all of that came from 9/11. And yes, I was very much skeptical when I heard that they had had a 40-minute firefight with the most dangerous, most highly trained, most vicious killers on the planet. And the brave SEALs had escaped without a scratch. There's no firefight ever lasted 40 minutes and people didn't get a scratch. And then we were told that they had dumped a body in the ocean. So that told me there wasn't a body. They didn't have a body. Because that's the last thing they would do. They would certainly display the body. And furthermore, they wouldn't have killed him because they wouldn't even have to have a firefight. They'd just cut off any supplies going in and any movement out and eventually capture him, and we would have the font of information of all the terror networks. So it didn't make any sense. And, of course, the story instantly was changed, and it didn't last 48 hours before it was an entirely different story that bore no relationship whatsoever to the first story.
Well, I count about six different versions before the White House clamped down and just said, we're not going to talk about it anymore.
Right. But to go back to 9/11, you know, we do have the evidence from architects, from structural engineers, from the people who built the building and said it was engineered to take multiple hits from jetliners. We have the evidence of firemen. There's now a group called Firemen for 9/11 Truth, and there were over 100 of what I think they call them first responders who were actually in the buildings as they were blowing up. And they say, look, we not only heard a series of explosions, some from subfloors down in the basement, but some of us actually experienced it. We were blown around. And there's so much evidence that, and of course we have, it's now been proven that the Building 7 during part of its fall was in free fall, which means there had to have been explosives. We have Silverstein, who had the lease on the buildings on public television, saying the decision was made to pull it.
Mm-hmm.
There's just so much.
Well, and we also have the last known interview with Osama bin Laden, in which he disclaimed any direct responsibility for 9/11. Right. We have the American FBI, in a filing that was not given much notice in the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui, where they said, well, we actually haven't charged Osama bin Laden with anything related to 9/11 because we don't have any evidence to connect him.
Yeah, I'm going to get to all that. That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me just add one thing to this. The thing that strikes me, having been 25 years in Washington, is that let's assume the 9/11 story that government gave us is correct, and that a few Muslims outwitted not just the FBI and CIA, but all 16 American intelligence agencies, all the intelligence agencies of our allies, including Israel's Mossad, outwitted NORAD, the National Security Council, airport security four times in 1 hour on the same morning, and so on and so on, and pull this off. Now, what I know is that if that had actually happened, the president, the Congress, the media would be screaming to know how this possibly could have happened.
Mm-hmm.
There would have been every kind of demand for explanation and accountability. Somebody would have been held responsible. Instead, if I remember, the 9/11 families had to struggle with Bush and Cheney for 1 or 2 years to get even that political commission appointed. And all the political commission did was sit there and listen to whatever the government chose to tell it. And then we had, after the report comes out, the two co-chairmen, or the chairman and the vice chairman of the commission, and the chief legal counsel all write books and say, we were lied to on a number of occasions. The military lied to us. NORAD lied to us. CIA lied to us. Well, nothing has happened. No, Congress had never said, well, let's investigate that. Why did you lie to the commission? So I just take it that for most Americans, 9/11 ended the first day when they were told that it was Muslim terrorists. And they all know that, and they haven't paid any attention since. And the same with bin Laden. That began and ended with four words. We got bin Laden. They don't pay any attention or any sense. So I think the sort of insouciance or the indifference or whatever it is about Americans that now permits the government to not even make the effort to tell credible lies means the government doesn't expect ever to be held accountable. And I think that's where that's where we are. You know, we have this latest war we're in. The president didn't even inform the Congress. You know, the Congress is supposed to have the war-making power, and they gave it up many decades ago, but it was replaced by the president coming to them and saying, we had to do it for this reason, won't you approve it? Well, this latest war, he hasn't even done that. So I think what we have in the White House, and it has nothing to do per se with Obama, it's just what the office has evolved into, is a Caesar. He's above the law as long as we're at war. If we're at war, he doesn't have to respect the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, habeas corpus, due process, attorney-client privilege, right to attorney. He doesn't have to respect American statutory laws against torture or international laws and treaties against torture. He's independent of all law as long as we're at war. And this came out of the Bush-Cheney Justice Department with those memos that John Yoo and a couple of others. The other guy now is a federal judge who wrote these memos, and John Yoo is a tenured professor at the University of California, Berkeley, in the law school. So we have now Caesar, based on 9/11 and based on memos asserting that if the United States is at war, the president is not bound by law or the Constitution. So he's a Caesar.
Mr. Robert, we'll
be at war the rest of our lives.
Correct. And you say the military security complex cannot do without a bad guy, or the budget could be cut and billions of dollars in profits would go missing. Without someone for Americans to hate, the show just can't go on. And this is after Bin Laden's supposed alleged death. And then you ask the question, who is the next black hat? And who do you think the next black hat, or which group, or what objective is going to replace the Bin Laden hat?
I don't know. They're after Iran. They're after Syria. I think what Libya is about is driving China out of its oil investments. What Syria is about is driving the Russians out of their Mediterranean naval base. So it's starting to get very risky because China and Russia are not Iraq or Afghanistan. China owns us. They're our biggest banker, and the Russian nuclear missiles are still there, and they can terminate the world. So it's getting to be very risky. Saibel, I wouldn't be surprised if the next thing Obama tells us is that, Bin Laden escaped. That was a double. We got. He's escaped, and he's abroad doing his nefarious deeds. They can't do without him, so they'll have to have...
Well, the media has been helping that because 2 days ago, Washington Post had a front-page article about Al-Qaeda franchisees. And how actually Bin Laden set up this organization that they basically obtained franchisee rights, and now they have franchisees in Somalia and in Yemen. So the brand Al-Qaeda seems to be thriving on its own with or without Bin Laden. And if you remember, in 2004 or 2005, Bush came out and said Bin Laden is irrelevant. You know, this war on terror took its own life, did its own thing, and the brand became Al-Qaeda. One day we are dealing with Al-Qaeda in Yemen, the next day is Somalia, the next day is in Philippines. So we have this McLaren or McQaeda based on McDonald version, according to the U.S. media. And this is how they are putting it, because after Bin Laden's alleged death,
Just a couple of days later, they renewed the Patriot Act, and this time for 4 years, the Congress. You know, they started talking about how this actually increased the risk of retaliation. And then, of course, with the media constantly fueling this and coming up with the latest of this importance of these franchisees, we didn't really, it doesn't affect this so-called war on terror, because the brand Al-Qaeda is there, and unlike the Cold War with the Soviet Union, we don't even have some kind of a, you know, wall to come down, like the Berlin Wall, or a country to collapse. This is one of those perpetual war that can go on forever. How can it end?
Well, yes, I think, you see, the military security complex is the only industry we didn't move offshore. It's the only thing, it's the only thing we have. So if they stop the wars, there'll be no employment. You know, all this Al-Qaeda stuff, you would know more about this than me, but I'm really suspicious that this really exists, this Al-Qaeda, for many reasons I'm suspicious. One is that we were so quick to conflate Al-Qaeda with the Taliban. Of course, the Taliban's not Al-Qaeda, and in most American minds, Al-Qaeda was what we were fighting in Iraq. And I think Al-Qaeda, it may be some kind of CIA operation.
Mr. Roberts, I walked into the FBI 3 days after 9/11, and I'm in this department with 250 other language specialists. And the Arabic units, these are the people who are monitoring Saudi Arabia and all the Arabic-speaking nations, including the ones in North Africa. They were working there side by side with me, and of course, other Central Asian languages, et cetera. And what I was told, and I heard that from almost every single language specialist that I work with in there, that they did not have anything to do with Al-Qaeda ever until September 11th. I mean, I know we had some 1998, 1999 mentions. It just popped up once or twice. They had issues and cases that they worked on that referred to certain people as Mujahideen. And those Mujahideen, as you know, that was the brand that was always associated with us and the CIA, because Mujahideen, for a decade, they milked this Mujahideen label. They were our friends, and they fought the big fight against the Soviet, you know, in Afghanistan. So they have to change this brand, because if they came and used the same one that they were getting through some intelligence, again, had nothing to do with September 11, but these groups, they were called Mujahideens, and all the counterintelligence language specialists, they always translated this as under the files, either counterterrorism or counterintelligence, Mujahideen. That suddenly, overnight, after September 11, it changed to Al-Qaeda. Anywhere they would see anything that had to do with those previous Mujahideen or Taliban groups, they just converted it to Al-Qaeda. But these language specialists, these are people with top secret clearance, they said they never dealt with anything that had Al-Qaeda in it. And this group included all the FBI's Arabic language specialists who've been there for 15 years, 20 years, 10 years, and they never dealt with the name Al-Qaeda until September 11th.
Well, then you support my suspicions.
Absolutely.
You're saying the evidence supports my position. I just don't believe that there's any such organization. And also, I think the accepted opinion of experts, including CIA people, is that bin Laden died in December of 2001. As Peter said earlier in this conversation, in his last known video, he denied having anything to do with it and said that the American people weren't his target. And so I think it's just a hoax you know, we're living in a whole, it's like The Matrix, you know, the film, The Matrix.
Yeah.
Or it's like George Orwell's Big Brother, the existence people have there. Everything is a hoax. Everything people are told is wrong. They receive reports of wars and so on. And I think that we live a hoax. And it's very, and there's no media. We don't have a media. There's no media. The media was never very good. Because of the Cold War, it was always easy to manipulate. But after Clinton let a few mega firms concentrate the media, that was the end of it. Because it's no longer run by journalists. It's run by corporate advertising executives.
You're right.
And the value of the mega companies is in the broadcast licenses that the government hands out. And so if they get on the wrong side of the government, the licenses aren't renewed, and the tens of billions or hundreds of billions or whatever these mega concerns are worth disappear. They go up in smoke. And so there's no media. There's a ministry, I call it the Ministry of Truth, or it's a propaganda ministry, or as Gerald Celente calls them, prostitutes. And I think that there's no hope of the media ever telling the people anything that's not what the government wants them to hear. In fact, I think some of the newspapers are in such a dire financial straits, possibly the Washington Post is in that kind of a situation, that they're essentially supported by CIA money.
One of the concerns that I have with the events of May 1st, May 2nd in Abbottabad, as delivered into the American media and bought hook, line, and sinker by the public. We show polls that say 85% flatly support what the president said he decided to do. And my concern is that we didn't even charge Osama bin Laden with a crime.
Right.
And it's widely believed that he was responsible for the embassy attacks in 98 and the attack on the coal in 2000. But we've never bothered to prove it. And we didn't even put together a kangaroo court military commission to either charge or convict him in absentia at Guantanamo. And my real concern is that because Americans just widely believe that it was either justifiable or even justice to summarily execute Osama bin Laden, that this creates a whole new slippery slope. And just 5 days after the reported events in Abbottabad, we publicly announced that we had launched Predator drone strikes into the civil war-torn country of Yemen in an attempt to summarily execute an American citizen, Anwar al-Awlaki. And he is an imam who is, you know, it has been reported in the American media that he was in email contact with Hassan, the shooter at Fort Hood, Texas, that he was in email contact with Abdul Muttalib, the young man with the underpants that were supposed to explode on the flight to Detroit but didn't. And those are the, you know, the circumstantial bits of evidence that have been presented. But I am extremely uncomfortable with the idea that the president can issue a covert finding to execute an American citizen who has never been charged or convicted of the crimes that are alleged.
Well, it's like I said earlier, he's Caesar. There's no legal restraint on him. That was what came out of the Justice Department memos. That's why they can hold people in indefinite detention, including American citizens. And that's why they can murder whoever they want, not just Americans, but anybody else. So the United States is lawless. It's lawless. The government is lawless. The president is immune to any kind of legal prosecution. Look, it's now known for a fact. A lot of ordinary people now who don't pay any attention, they figured out that there weren't any weapons of mass destruction and that President Bush knew it. The British certainly know that Blair knew there was none because of the Downing Street memo being released and because of the commission that they've been holding there in England taking testimony. So Blair knew there were no weapons. Bush knew. Cheney knew. So we went to war based on a lie. And what did President Obama say? Oh, we're not looking backward. We're only looking forward. We're not going to do anything about this. Well, this is a huge difference from the Nixon era, when Nixon apparently lied about when he learned of a burglary of which he had nothing to do with. But he said he learned about it later than he did, in order to avoid being asked, why didn't you do something about it quicker, when the obvious answer was it would right in the middle of a re-election. It's the last thing any president wants to. But the Washington Post made a big issue of it. But they make no issue of these monstrous crimes. I mean, you know, there are large numbers of dead, maimed Iraqis. I think 4 million displaced. The whole country's ruined. We lost 4,000 or 5,000 troops. 30,000 or 40,000 injured. A lot of them having a post-traumatic stress. According to Joseph Stiglitz and the Harvard budget expert, the Iraq wars cost us $3 trillion in already out-of-pocket and future incurred expenses, and there's to be no accountability. So I think what we have to accept is a blatant fact that the government is lawless. President is not accountable to law, and it doesn't matter about elections because whoever gets in there is the same as who left. What's the difference between Obama and Bush?
Well, that's exactly where I'd like to go next. Paul Craig Roberts is with us here on The Boiling Frogs, and just this past week, we're speaking, by the way, during the third week of May. The Supreme Court declined to review a case brought up from the Ninth Circuit here in San Francisco. And this was a case that was brought by Binyan Muhammad and four other former Guantanamo prisoners. And they sued Jeppesen Aviation, a division of Boeing, which we all know was the agency that provided the jets, the private jets that were leased to the government to transport individuals who were kidnapped or otherwise detained, and some of them were sent to third countries where they were tortured, some were sent to black sites, some were ultimately delivered to Guantanamo. And the New York Times, to its credit, wrote a very excoriating editorial in the Sunday paper about the failure of the court to pick up this case for review. But they really didn't properly rebuke the president and the Justice Department for extending, in my view, the bad precedents that were established under George W. Bush regarding executive power, and the supposition, the assertion that these issues are beyond the review of the American courts. And I think that this case, the Jeppesen case, is a very ripe one because the information is out there on the public record. And yet they want to pretend that it's secret and that any attempt by these individuals to get some sort of justice for what they suffered at our hands is subjugated to this passionate defense of so-called state secrets. And this applies to the wiretapping cases as well, where they produce a catch-22 where citizens are not allowed to sue because they can't prove that they were wiretapped. And even in the case of the Al Haramain charity that has proved that they were wiretapped and has received a judgment in their favor, the government continues to play games and keep all these things under wraps. So my question to you with that long-winded introduction is Obama worse than Bush on these issues?
Well, I think he is, but it's not because it's Obama. It's just because Washington gains a bit of power. It never gives it up. It just adds to it. So this is just the implications unfolding, and Obama is simply there presiding over them. It's not really even him doing it. He's just there. It wouldn't much matter who the president was, you know, unless it's William Blackstone or somebody from the past, you know. The implications of lawlessness, government lawlessness, are unfolding. And that's what we're seeing. And the courts have acquiesced. Any number of scholars of international law have written books proving that the claim of national security or state secrets has only one purpose, and that is to hide the government's crimes. It doesn't have any other purpose, and it's never, ever invoked except to hide the government's crimes. And that's what the whole concept is. I mean, you know, try to think of some sort of national security secret that would matter. I mean, other than when you had a monopoly on nuclear weapons, how to build a nuclear weapon, that would be a real secret. When you had a monopoly on intercontinental ballistic missiles, that would be a real secret. And maybe your military strategy for the war you're about to get into. But other than that, there aren't any. And the things they claim are secret are not secret. And they don't matter. I had top secret and higher clearances for a goodly number of years in Washington. I never saw anything that mattered. And I just don't believe that the thing is ever used except to avoid the government being accountable. And that's its main function. And it's hard to believe that people on the Supreme Court don't know that, or that federal judges don't know that. But I think what they know is that if they were to make some ruling against the government on that issue, the government would not comply. And so they probably feel that they would be contributing to a more rapid collapse of law. Because if the court makes a ruling, the government says go to hell, then you can't even pretend to have a rule of law. And I think the judges and the Supreme Court, they like to pretend as long as they can, because they think the pretense itself puts something of a check on the government.
That's absolutely true. I mean, I was the recipient of the infamous state secrets privilege. In fact, I was the first recipient of state secrets privilege under the Bush administration. Then in 2004, they invoked it again. And basically, they went and told the judge that they couldn't even give him documents explaining why these issues were considered state secrets privilege, and because the even the judge didn't have clearance that high.
Right.
And the judge, the court, accepted that. So, meaning without reviewing any evidence from the government, the judge granted the government what they wanted, saying, well, we have this war on terror, September 11 happened, and if the government says these issues are covered by the state secrets privilege, who am I, a judge, to contradict that or even evaluate that? In fact, he wrote that in his opinion.
Right.
And then it went to the appellate court, and then three judges agreed with that. And then after that, it went to the Supreme Court, and those judges there agreed that this case could not be have been heard at the Supreme Court level. And absolutely true. And we have been talking about these issues during our both. I have been talking about it in my articles. We have been interviewing people. It's all these what that basically everybody, at least the those people who are aware, they agree that yes, it's not that we are moving towards a police state. We are one.
Yes.
And you, Mr. Roberts, had this great article after the FBI raids against the homes of anti-war activists in Illinois, Minneapolis, Michigan. And I want to read this really powerful paragraph that you wrote. We're talking about violent extremism being one of those undefined police state terms that will mean whatever the government wants it to mean. And that morning, after this FBI raid, they accused these activists. They said, well, they were providing material support to terrorism. And you say, just as conservatives equated Vietnam-era anti-war protesters with giving material support to communism. So we have all these what's. But what we never get to is, and this is us, all of us, is what can be done. Because there are those days that it feels so very hopeless that I get so disgusted. And this happened after I went all the way to the Supreme Court saying, you know, what the heck, there is nothing I can do. And it was just blowing in the wind. Then the alternative is doing nothing, saying nothing, which feels even worse. Then I go back and I pick up where I left, and then I end up in the same position again. You yourself had that piece in 2010, disgusted with the state of things, and you said, okay, this is my last piece, but you couldn't stay away either. The question becomes, have we reached this point of no return? I mean, this is it? Or are there things that truly can be done to challenge this?
I don't think anything can be done, because as far as I can see, there's no concern in the legal profession. The bar associations aren't upset. The law schools aren't upset. Like I say, John Yu is a tenured professor at Boat Hall School of Law. The other memo writer is a federal judge. There's the media is not concerned. The people aren't concerned. They're scared. They're going to get terrorists. They don't care how. What, in my opinion, will check it, if it's checked, is the abuse of the dollar. You know, they can't finance the government except by printing money. This is destroying the dollar as reserve currency. The rest of the world is looking at the process of the dollar being destroyed. Many of them are complaining loudly, the Brazilians, the Chinese, the Russians. If the dollar is destroyed, so is Washington's power. Its entire power is based on the ability to pay its bills in its own currency, its foreign bills, its import bills. If you can't pay for the oil by printing dollars because nobody wants the dollars, you're in trouble. If you can't pay for your manufactured goods, we're now totally dependent on manufacturing imports. And people say, well, you've inflated your currency out of existence. We don't want it. So that's a check on their power. Another check is their hubris and their arrogance is reached now beyond small countries that were unable to defend themselves, like Iraq. And they're now toying with the Chinese and the Russians. As I said earlier, what Libya is about, if you notice, the so-called protest in Libya did not originate in the capital. It was not peaceful. It originated in the east where the oil is, and it's armed. And it's directed at evicting China from its oil investments in eastern Libya. That's what this is about.
Sure.
And all the, and we had reports from the very beginning that the CIA was involved.
Sure.
And now we have the same thing in Syria. We have reports that we are funding the opposition. And we want to overthrow that government because the Russians have a massive naval base there. And the Russian president has announced that it will be, all the renovation will be finished by 2012, and it will be a base for permanently having aircraft carriers and guided missile cruisers. Well, that's the last thing the Americans want in the Mediterranean. So they're at work to overthrow Assad. Well, the Russians know that. The Chinese know what Libya is about. The American people haven't a clue. They never will know. But the Russians and Chinese know, and they can see the aggressiveness. And that, in my opinion, we're leading into World War III. and not with Iraq and Yemen, but with powers capable of defeating us.
And with these comments in mind, Paul Craig Roberts, what was your reaction to President Obama's State Department speech a week ago for us now, or last week, actually, in advance of the visit of Prime Minister Netanyahu from Israel, the clear tension between the U.S. and Israel, because Obama went from being 1,000% supportive of Israel to, 900%. And I'm curious about your thoughts, A, about his speech about the region in general, and then B, in particular, about Israel and Palestine.
Well, I think he went from 1,000 to 2,000. And the whole thing was just another hoax. But and he's already backed off from it. You know, he why he did it, I'm not sure. But what it really signals is war. What it really signals is that we're not through yet. We need to get rid of Iran and Syria and anybody else and Pakistan and anybody else that doesn't do what we tell them. And by the way, Israel, if you guys would cool it a bit, we wouldn't risk losing Saudi Arabia or the oil emirates. They wouldn't have to kind of back off from us because of all the unrest in their own country. So would you please cool it? That Netanyahu, I think that's all that was about. And I think it is a signal that there's more war. And how many times did Obama say that we're absolutely committed to the defense of Israel? He said over and over and over, the defense of Israel, security of Israel. I don't think he backed off anything. I think that he probably said some of those things trying to make it easier for the Saudis to hold on, make it easier for the countries that are faced with protests that we don't orchestrate. But I don't think it had any real meaning in terms of, Israel isn't going to go back to the 67 border. In fact, Obama didn't even say that. He talked about land swaps, but he didn't define them. So Israel can say, okay, we'll keep the West Bank and give you a block in East Jerusalem. So, the whole thing is just more hoax, more propaganda, more lies, more ways of confusing people. And everybody will hear it in different ways. They'll hear what they want to hear. And that's usually what happens when the president says something.
Correct. This is what you had to say on this. Today, Americans are ruled by propaganda. Americans have little regard for truth, little access to it, and little ability to recognize it. Truth is an unwelcome entity. It's disturbing. It is off limits. Those who speak it run the risk of being branded anti-American, anti-Semite, and conspiracy theorists. How did it start, this disdain, when it comes to truth and the American people?
Well, that's a good question. We don't have time to get to that now. I'm sure it starts in wars because wars are always sold on the basis of lies. For example, the American Civil War was about slavery, they say. It was about empire. World War I was a war to end all wars, and it wasn't. And whatever they tell you. And Vietnam, it's a domino theory. And Iraq, it's weapons of mass destruction. And then there are other things that happened, like 9/11 or John F. Kennedy's assassination. They always have to have a story. And so the lies crowd out truth. Nobody wants to know the truth. It's disturbing, like I said. And so it's easy for the government not to tell it. because people don't want to hear it in the first place. You know, if you think about it, the audience that we have is small. It's intelligent, and they're concerned. But they're probably not the 20% of the population that it would take to actually have any change. But the rest of the people, if they were to even hear what we've talked about this last hour, they would be outraged. They'd be absolutely convinced that I was some kind of a Bolshevik that wanted to murder them in their bed. And that's just the situation. That's the fact. And I think we have to keep doing what we can, because there are people out there who need to hear, because they know themselves, and they feel funny if they don't hear anybody tell them what they know. But most of the people, they just, you know, they're into reality shows or rock music or sports. What's the football team doing? Or shopping centers? Or they don't have the time or energy or the education and background or interests to know about these things. And Americans have just sort of, I think, trusted their government blindly, really, since the Great Depression, since Franklin D. Roosevelt. Government looks after us.
And I wonder, as we wrap up here, Paul Craig Roberts, if you would talk about your own political odyssey, because you started out as a young Republican economist working for some very serious Republican leaders, Reagan, Kemp, Orrin Hatch. And you seem to have evolved into somebody who is pretty disaffected with our political process. And I'd just like to get your sense of this route that you took. And do you see any bright spots in the future, or are we basically on a downward spiral and we need to recognize that and try to make the best of a bad situation?
Well, I think we're on a downward spiral. But look, you know, Hatch, Kemp, Reagan, they were concerned with real issues. We had a serious problem. It was called stagflation. Inflation and unemployment were rising together. And the economic policy at the time had no answer to that. They didn't know why this was happening. It's not supposed to. You're supposed to be able to push up employment with inflation. You're supposed to be able to push inflation down with unemployment. And it ceased to work. And we were still in the Cold War, and the economy seemed to be failing. And it was a serious problem, and those three were trying to deal with that problem. And Reagan also was trying to deal with another serious problem, which was the Cold War. He wanted to end it. He kept saying over and over, once I get the economy fixed, I'm going to end the Cold War, because the Russians can't fix their economy. If we fix ours, I can convince them that they can't stand an arms race, and I'll get them to negotiate, and we'll end the Cold War. And that was his goal. Well, he achieved both goals. So they were different people. They actually would face real problems and deal with real problems. Today, the politicians don't face any real problem. That's the whole outcome of this hour's discussion three of us have had. There's not a single real problem out there they will face. They face make-believe problems, hoaxes, non-existent threats. It's not anything like the people that were there 30 years ago, or whenever it was I was there. It was 30 years ago, wasn't it? Yeah. It was a different world. And of course, Kemp is dead, Reagan is dead, and Orrin Hatch has had to change with the world in order to survive, and he's not the same Orrin Hatch.
I would agree.
And so that's happened to all of them. And, in fact, the interest groups are so powerful now. Nobody is independent of the interest groups. The president is not the most powerful man. Wall Street or the military security complex or some black ops organization, the CIA, or you can't go against the interest groups. Try going against AIPAC. Can't be done. And any number of former senators and congressmen have said, oh, boy, you don't do it, AIPAC won't, you're out. I'm proof of the fact. And any number of interest groups can produce that result. So it's not a democracy. It's an oligarchy. It's ruled by private interest groups who control politics because they control campaign contributions, campaign finance. And the Supreme Court recently gave them ever more power to do that. So I think the notion that the United States is a democracy, that's another hoax. And we can add it to the hoax that we have a rule of law and all the other hoaxes that we've talked about today.
Paul Craig Roberts, thank you for joining us today on The Boiling Frogs.
I'm pleased to talk to two intelligent and aware people. It was a pleasure for me.
Thank you, Mr. Roberts.
And now, comedian satirist Will Durst, who I recently saw do his stand-up performance live, and it killed. It was just deadly. He's got a weekly commentary for you about the self-inflicted wounds by Twitter of one Representative Anthony Weiner.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here, and trust me, I really wanted to avoid the whole crotch-tweeting thing altogether, but it's like trying to ignore a bullfight in a broom closet. The unfortunately named Anthony Weiner has sucked all the oxygen out of the news cycle. It's almost impossible to find out what the subject of today's Sarah Palin revisionist history lesson was. Did Abraham Lincoln declare war on the French to protect tort reform? This whole thing is the New York Democrats' own damn fault. You know that. Wouldn't have been half the outcry if his name wasn't Weiner. Hey, he had a choice of pronunciation. Could have taken a page out of the John Boehner playbook. Of course, Boehner and Boehner is way different than Weiner and Weiner. Weiner is still a lousy name for a politician. Appropriate, especially for a Democrat, but lousy. The guy is screwed either way. Of course, he could have gone bold. Yes, it's spelled W-E-I-N-E-R, but it's pronounced Schultz. First Congressman Weiner, and boy, isn't that turning out to be redundant, lied about his unique approach to junk mail, but after allegations started piling up like parking tickets on an abandoned VW van in a white zone, he broke down and admitted his compulsion. One of the six people he claims to have sexted was a porn star who he then tried to get to lie about the relationship, but she refused. Pretty sad when the porn industry has a higher standard of integrity than members of Congress. His sole consolation is that his parents didn't add to the misery by giving him the first name of Richard, or Harry. It's Anthony. Tony Weiner, which sounds like a high-class hot dog. Or the mascot in that animated short we saw in fifth grade health class about the reproductive system. Hi, kids. I'm Tony Weiner. Ready to take an exciting ride down the fallopian tube? Okay, hard hats on. Let's go. And now it turns out that Bill Clinton officiated at the guy's wedding. Well, that explains it all. Looks like we can classify the former president as a carrier. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
Give me absolute control over every living soul in that sandy baby. That's an order. Take the only tree that's left. Stuff it up the hole in your culture. Give me the back of a burning wall. Give me a star. I've seen the future, brother. It is murder.
Leo Cohen and the future. The future. Well, that depends on us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.